following is Samuel Bowles' talk, Organizational Nerve, Designing Teams to Feel and Innovate, from the 2013 Information Architecture Summit. The 2013 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
I have to admit, I'm not Dutch at all. I know he printed to his t-shirt that says Dutch Empire, but it's true. Grand Rapids, Michigan is a Dutch mecca. I figure I must be Dutch by osmosis by now. But I would like to talk to you guys today about some of the things that have been happening in our company. And one of the things I want to tell you first off is some of the things I'm not going to do in this session. I am not going to give you a list of 10 silver bullets that are going to fix your companies. I don't have some snake oil that can make everything all better. And so what I am going to do is I'm going to tell some stories. I'm really going to tell the story of where we've been over the course of the last 2 years or so. Like Dan said, my name is Samuel Bowles. You can find me on Twitter at Schmuel. And yeah, let's get started. One of the things you need to know about me is that I have always been fascinated for the entirety of my career with the idea of solving really complex problems and making the confounding seem elementary. The way that I've approached that is using my creativity. I started out in sort of the advertising and marketing area, and I was working in an advertising firm one time, and I was working on a WYSIWYG interface. It was rather complex, and I drew one of the developers over to show him what I was working on. I said, you know, look at this amazing thing I've done. He looked at what I have done, and he listened to me explain it for about 2 minutes before he declared, very quickly, no, can't do that. And he walked away. And I was just floored. I was crushed. Not only was I crushed, I was perplexed. I didn't understand. I thought for sure this thing had to be feasible. There had to be a way. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to prove him wrong. So I found the JavaScript manuals online, and I started coding up a functional prototype. Now, keep in mind, I was young. I realized that this is not a great way to win friends or influence people. But I did it. I figured it out. I figured out how to build this functional prototype. And I got it up and running, and it worked. But I learned something more important than JavaScript from that situation. I learned that in order for my ideas to see the light of day, in order to have success in getting these ideas to have traction, I needed the technical competency to be able to communicate about the feasibility of my ideas. And so I went on a journey. I went on a journey to improve my technical skills. I spent years just learning languages and databases and trying to understand enough in my free time that when I came back to work, I was going to be able to have a conversation with the developers, and they weren't going to be able to do what they did before and say, no, you can't do that. But as I went along this path, I realized that, yeah, I had the creativity and I had the technical competence at this point, but there was another, even larger gap in my knowledge, a larger gap that I didn't know how I was going to fill, and I realized it was going to take me years to fill it. The gap was I realized that in order to have my ideas take root, I really needed to understand the needs and the language of business. And so I embarked on yet another journey to try to understand how I would be able to understand these. So I started a design firm, and I learned that cash flow is hard. And then I took those lessons, I went overseas, and I started an international design firm, and I learned that communication is hard. And so then I became a minority partner in a mobile software company, and I learned that you really need to trust your gut on people. And so I came back to the US and I started working for a widely respected software engineering firm. And I learned some really incredible things. I learned about agile, lean, measurement, metrics. And it was really, really amazing, head-blowing stuff. But I also learned that pursuing efficiency has two sides to it, that it can do great good and it can do great harm. And I wondered, is there a better way? Is there a better way to pursue these things that preserves a sense of humanity? Actually, let me stop here for one thing I forgot to say at the beginning. If you're taking notes, don't bother. I have written down more detailed notes than you can imagine on everything that I'm going to say in this presentation. You can just sit back, enjoy the story, and then when I'm done, I will post the notes for everyone. So if you want to take your own notes, I totally understand. But so it was at this point, as I was pursuing this, that I joined a company called Mutually Human. Now, Mutually Human shared so many of my values. Even the name spoke to things that I was deeply, deeply believed in. And so I had this new context from which I could explore how you would integrate a creative and engineering culture. I wasn't sure it was possible, but at least I could experiment. But as I started on this journey and these experiments, I kept asking myself this one question over and over again. I asked myself, are there general principles for organizational design? Are there things that I can turn to that will tell me what I should be thinking about? And so I looked backward to the companies that I had worked for in the past, and I looked for heuristics. I looked for examples that I could draw from, and I looked to the engineering company, and I realized that this quest for efficiency could easily sort of slip into a kind of neo-Taylorism. And that while measurement and economic efficiency and productivity were good, if you took them to their logical extremes, they could be dehumanizing. So I looked to the mobile software company, and I forgot a piece of paper. You know what? We're going to try something here. I realized that my business partner visualized things more than he measured. And I got an email from him one day, and I'm going to try something here because I made, for all my preparation, I made a mistake here. I'm going to read to you this email that he sent me. Okay, I quote, "Hi, this request may sound odd, but it's important to me. I want to use it to visualize. Please create a graphic of a Fast Company magazine cover and an Inc. magazine cover and put my face on. Then put the text of mobile domination. Please don't think my leaving you out is in any way anything. It's not. Simply, this is just for my visualization work. I know you're busy. Thanks." Now, I was busy. I was launching about 4 different products for the company in that week. I didn't respond to the email. I had no idea how. So I decided, you know, looking back at these companies, it wasn't getting me very much of anywhere. I turned to the management gurus. I read Taylor and Drucker and Ono, and I was reading Ono's book, The Toyota Production System, Taichi Ono's book, The Toyota Production System, when I came across the 7 wastes. And the 7 wastes Taichi Ono outlined as a way of thinking about the types of things you needed to eliminate to achieve true efficiency. He listed overproduction, time, transportation, processing, inventory, movement, and defects. And as I thought about these, I wondered, what would the corollaries to these be in an information economy? And one of them stood out to me in particular. Taichi Ono talked about transportation waste. And I realized that we don't transport as many atoms as we used to, especially in the kinds of jobs that we do. But we do transport bits and ideas regularly. We might call transportation communication. And I began to wonder if this might be the key waste in a company in an information economy. And as I looked at the different ways that we communicate, I thought about, you know, talking by the phone, talking by email, in person. I realized that they were all bound by bandwidth constraints. They had corrupt packets. They had routing errors. And even getting your message through proved to be incredibly difficult. And not only that, even when we weren't trying to communicate with other people, we had to communicate with ourselves every time we changed context. We would transport information from our long-term memory to our short-term memory and back again. And so each time we were changing context, we had to manage this waste. In fact, David Meyer, the director of Brain Cognition and Action Lab at University of Michigan, noted that when we multitask, it actually doubles the amount of time on task when we're achieving things, or more. And there is an increased occurrence of error rates in the work that we do. So as one of the people in our company who's making recommendations about capacity planning for all of the people in the organization, not only could I be slowing my teammates down and increasing the error rate in the work that they do, but I could be making them miserable as well. As Dr. Barry Schwartz talks about in his Paradox of Choice, managing these different priorities and trying to figure out which thing you should be working on can result in people being miserable. So the thing I wanted was something I just didn't have. I didn't have a model. I didn't have my shining example of an organization that I could look to, at least not one that was close enough to home that I could actually learn from them directly. And so I started looking around for other organizations near me, and I came to a terrible realization. So I want to ask you guys a question. How many of you know of an organization, maybe even yours, that would consider itself lean? You? Okay. And how many of those actually are? A lot of the hands just went down of those who raised them the first time. I realized there was this incredible noise to signal in the companies that I was looking to for a model. There were people who said they were applying these principles. Maybe they said they were doing lean startup, which is great. I have found that there's a lot more depth to what Taichi Ono was doing than some of the principles that come out of the lean startup movement. So I took a lateral step. I realized that nature had 3.8 billion years on us in terms of creating a continuous improvement system. And so I took a course in biomimetics. And as I took this course, biomimetics is the application of nature's design principles. In fact, the biomimicry group calls it the conscious emulation of nature's genius. And as I studied this biomimetic stuff, I realized that nature has this incredible economy of means. As you look at nature, there's so little waste. That which we consider waste gets immediately recycled back into the cycle of nature. It even, as you look at it, it makes you question if we recycle at all. The level at which nature recycles is amazing. And I also discovered that in the field of biomimetics, they had come up with a set of design principles called life's principles. And life's principles were these: evolve to survive, be resource efficient, adapt to changing conditions, integrate development and growth, be locally attuned and responsive, and use life-friendly materials. I saw on this list two that seemed particularly ripe for me to begin, easy enough for me to begin experimenting with, and they were these two. So I thought, can I come up with some experiments that may allow us to approach efficiency from a more human-friendly perspective, a perspective that would encourage the kind of humanity that I wanted to see? So under each one of these life's principles, the biomimetics group listed a list of strategies. And the strategies were these. Under evolve to survive, they listed replicate what works. And I thought of Mandelbrot's fractals and how he demonstrated that the simplest rule repeated over and over and over again can create these incredibly complex systems. And I realized we needed to look inward at our organization and look for these rules, these things that we were doing right that we could replicate over and over and over again. They talked about integrating the unexpected. And I realized that one of the things that this meant to me was embracing failure. And one of the ways we embrace failure in our organization is at the end of each project, we do a project retrospective. So we have a list of criteria, project criteria, And when we get to the end of the project, we reflect on whether or not we met those. And the way we do this is we put the criteria up on a whiteboard, and we put up pluses and deltas, things that went really well in the project and things we would change. We write them all down with the project team that worked on the project when it concludes, and then we share those with the rest of the organization so that the organizational learning that's happening can be spread throughout the rest of the company. And they talked about reshuffling information. One of the tools that we've found in our organization particularly helpful as we're trying to reshuffle and process new information is Edward de Bono's Six Thinking Hats. Under Adapt to Change, they talked about maintaining integrity through self-renewal. And I realized that most religions have a sort of recommendation of a rhythm of self-renewal. And we began to think of this as a biological imperative and thought that this is something that companies should really think about as well. So what we did in our company is we have periodic times during the flow of work. We're a consulting service, so we work on client projects all the time. And my friend Mike Karleski likes to talk about the fact that service firms often suffer from the tyranny of the billable hour. And we needed to find a way to fight this. So what we do is we stop every so often during the course of work, and we spend a month, and we just stop doing client work, and we focus on doing things that will expand our horizons and regenerate our creativity. And they talk about embodying resilience. One of the things we realized is that we had these points in our company where we had these single points of failure in our communication strategies. And we needed to find ways to decentralize communication, add variation into our communication, and provide redundancy. So these life's principles had given me really interesting things to think about, but what they didn't give me was my model. A model that I could look at. I didn't have an organizational model now, and I still didn't quite have a natural model either that I could look to. And I started thinking about Taichi Ono's work, and one of the things that I realized is that he was always really, really reticent to write down anything about the Toyota production system. He just didn't want to write it down. It became clear that he was really afraid of it becoming a crystallized dogma. He was afraid that there was an inherent paradox in taking a snapshot of a dynamic system, of a continuous improvement system, and that people would attempt to take the practices of Lean and begin copying them instead of following the path of discovery that he had laid out. So what did I have? I had my failures from the past. I had my frozen snapshot of a dynamic system. I had some design principles from nature. And I had an instinct that there was an evolutionary secret hiding in plain sight. I realized as well that in our organizations, human capital is so much more important than it is in manufacturing companies. Not that it isn't important in manufacturing companies, but we don't even own any machines in our company. We give our employees a supplement to be able to buy their own machines. We don't own machines at all. All we have are the people that work in our company. So I came up with a series of questions that I was still struggling with. And these were a few of them. I asked myself, how do you motivate people to act? How do you align their actions with the needs of the company? And how do you encourage continuous growth beyond the projects that we're working on? And it was while I was working on this presentation that I realized where my next leap came from. I didn't even realize where this seed had been planted. But again, I was reading Taichi Ono's book. It didn't even occur to me that this quote was in there. But as I went back, I realized it was there. He said, "The key to progress in production improvement, I feel, is letting the plant people feel the need." Letting the plant people feel the need. And it was at this point that I realized that there, in front of my face, was a natural system that was the best management system ever created, that was the best communication system ever devised, and it was the nervous system. As I thought about this, I went back to thinking about Mandelbrot's rules for his fractals. I thought about these really, really simple rules that create incredibly complex systems. I realized that we understand pretty well the mechanics of the way that nerves work. We understand the electrochemical signals that allow these information messages to spread throughout the body. But we're just beginning to discover what we don't know about how they work in concert. There are these amazing things that allow us to feel a stove when we touch it, and also appreciate a symphony. They can send us these nearly binary signals like, ouch, but they can also give us this sort of intangible sensation that we might be getting sick. And so I started doing research. I went deep. I called up neuroscientists and pestered them with questions. I watched documentaries. I read books. I did everything I could to just basically geek out on neuroscience. And as I went along and gathered this information, I then turned and I looked again for a heuristic. Now that I had this new lens to look through, I went looking for another heuristic, a company that might be able to show me an application of these nerve endings. And I got really, really lucky. I discovered a guy named Mark Peters. Now, Mark Peters is a guy that lives right in my backyard. He owns a company right in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's the CEO of Butterball Farms. Now, you may be familiar with Butterball Farms from their turkeys. His father invented the Butterball turkey, all of the processes and patents that go around the very first frozen turkey. It was a huge program, genetics program, and a bunch of stuff. It was a pretty impressive thing. And then he sold all those patents. But the other thing that Butterball does is Buttermall makes butter balls. So that's what they do today. Mark's father, their biggest customer, you've probably even encountered these or seen these, because their biggest customer is McDonald's. If you've ever had hotcakes at McDonald's, you've encountered Butterballs. But the thing you need to understand about Mark's father is Mark's father was an incredibly astute businessman, really incredibly astute businessman. But he was a pretty terrible manager, actually. So I'll give you an example. In the US, between 2000 and 2008, the turnover rate among employees was 3.3%. And at Butterball, in 1 year, they filed 800 W-2s. A W-2 is a US tax form that you have to file for each employee that you hire during the year. They fired 800 W-2s for a 140 employee company. Think about that for a minute. But it gets worse. That was really for 50 positions that were being churned. Mark got used to the idea that they would hire 20 people on Monday, and he would be happy if 5 people were left at the end of the week. And so when Mark took over the company, he decided, you know what? I have got to run a different kind of company. I am not satisfied with the fact that this company is, some of his employees just referred to it as, it's the place you go for work until you can get a real job. And he started making huge cultural changes. He created new lunchrooms. He put in new locker rooms. He instituted leadership training for the people who worked there. He started communicating in both Spanish and English. He did everything he could think of to improve the culture. Just culture, culture, culture. And it was a huge improvement. Not only did people stop thinking of it as a dead-end job, and they became an employer of choice for their employees. But customer service went up. And as their customer service went up, their sales went up. The company was growing, it was thriving, and his cultural changes were doing an incredible service to the company. But the thing that you have to understand about Mark is that Mark was not a numbers guy. And there was a problem. What Mark didn't realize was that the company had slipped into a negative cash flow position, which was something Mark didn't even understand. Their margins were shrinking. And one day, as Mark sat in his new office that was now on the plant floor, he sat in his office and he calculated that they had 60 days left until they were out of money entirely. So Mark, not being a numbers guy, went back to his spreadsheets and worked and worked and worked and tried to figure out, how did this happen? Why was this happening? He realized that he came up with a number. He called it a rough throughput number, which was basically a fully loaded pounds packed per labor hour. He was figuring out how many pounds of butter they were packing for each hour of work that was being spent. He found that they were currently at 18.5 pounds packed per labor hour. And that was going to result in a loss for the company of $228,000. He realized that increasing sales was not the answer, because for every pound of butter they sold, they were losing money. And he also calculated that in order to break even, they needed to get to 22 pounds packed per labor hour. He thought, that's good. I only have to increase it by 3.5 pounds packed per labor hour, not realizing that was a 20% increase in productivity for the company. So he came up with a crazy solution to this. He went to his plant leaders and he said, okay, look, this is what's happening with the company. 60 days and you're going to be out of a job. Here's what I want to do. You're currently making $12 an hour. I want you to go to $8 an hour. But if we go over 22 pounds packed per labor hour, I will split the difference in what we make with you 50-50. 50% of his plant leaders said, okay. The other 50 were like, no way. Within 30 days, the ones who had agreed were making more than the ones who hadn't. So they moved everyone over to the new compensation model. And within 60 days, they were at 24.5 pounds packed per labor hour, and they were at an annual profit of $720,000 a year. Which means that the people on the plant floor, these plant leaders who used to be making $35,000 a year for 60 hours of work a week, were now making $50,000 a year for 40 hours of work a week. It was incredible. Mark had stumbled onto a nerve that he could design into his organization that allowed his company to adapt. It allowed his company to evolve, and it allowed the people on the plant floor to feel both the pain and the pleasure of all of the decisions they were making. And it resulted not only in greater profit, it involved in incredible increases in productivity. People were working less for more money. So, looking back at our company, we actually failed at attempting to integrate some of these principles of creating alignment. And we learned a lot from the failure. So, the leadership team, we were all working on a strategic plan for the company, and we were thinking through a lot of different things about where we were going, and it constituted a moderate change in how we were doing things. And so we scheduled a meeting and we brought everybody together and we shared what we were working on. And it seemed to go well. There weren't very many questions, sort of eerily not enough questions. And so about 3 days later, after we had presented this stuff, we received three long letters from fellow teammates. And this is the point in the presentation that's actually hard to flip to the next slide. I'm about to share with you one of, I feel like, my greatest failures as a leader. These were devastating letters. And I asked permission from some of our teammates who shared these things with us if I could share some excerpts of the letters that they shared with us. And this is one of the things that was said. I feel misled. What communication I've had, basically, with Samuel in one-on-ones isn't matching what appear to be the opinions of the leadership team. Another person wrote, "It feels like my ability to be a fully contributing member of the team has been diminished. I worry that what it means is that I won't ever be the type of employee I used to be." This was crushing. This was just a devastating moment for all of us. Having your teammates feel misled, having your teammates feel diminished and demoralized, is the last thing any leader wants to feel. We were surprised by the communication. We were concerned by the miscommunication. And we also recognized that the feedback we got back was legitimate, valuable, and not universal. The feedback that we had gotten was really reflected to us that we needed to create multiple channels to communicate what we were communicating in the company. We needed to communicate to the various personalities and concerns that existed in our company. And this one meeting that we had scheduled was insufficient to communicate what it was that we were trying to communicate. We recognized that we needed to incorporate the concept of resilience into our organization. We needed to be able to adapt these concepts so that we could have redundancy in the way that we communicated, that we would have a more holistic way of communicating with the people in our organization that would really take into account where each of them was coming from. And so we thought about this, and we came up with what we consider to be the four senses of an organization. The four senses are participate, observe, listen, and measure. And at first, when we came up with this list, I sort of felt like I had them in an order of importance or an order of value, that maybe participation and actually working on the team was more valuable than observing from a distance and watching the things that were happening in our organization. I thought maybe that was better than just listening to people talk about what happened. And maybe that was, all of those were better than just measuring from a distance. But I realized that just like the human senses, it wasn't that each one of these was better or worse or more valuable than the others. It was that we needed all of them in order to be able to sense what was happening in the organization. No more than my eyesight is more important than my hearing, were any one of these more important than the other. Some of them were more visceral. They were more connected to what was happening in the organization, but they weren't necessarily more valuable. So we decided to do something. We decided to try to measure something that we didn't know if it was even measurable. We decided to come up with a value metric, a metric that would attempt to measure our culture in the company. And the way that we did this is we started with our values. In our company, we have what we call the six B's. The six B's are be passionate, be engaged, be generous, be collaborative, and be human. Now, these six B's, we took each one of the B's and we came up with a declarative statement for each one of them. The declarative statements were things like this. Our team is motivated by their own interests and enjoyment of work. Our team is free to take risks and fail in the pursuit of learning. We phrased them specifically for people to not think about themselves, but to think about how the whole team was performing. And we carefully worded them, carefully constructed them, and then we asked everyone to take a survey and rate each one of these phrases on a Likert scale from strongly agree to strongly disagree. And we took all of the information that we got back from this, we assembled it into a report card. Now, we didn't get an A. Would you like to see the report card? Okay. This was our report card. Now, each one of these bars indicates one of the statements that we ask people to rate on. The lower it is, the more they disagree. The higher it is, the more they agree. The gray bar, which is a little hard to see on the screen, along the bottom is the lowest answer we got for a particular criteria. The upper bar is the highest answer we got for a particular criteria. And one of the things that we realized as we presented this to the team was that not only was it a measurement, because I was always concerned that a measurement wouldn't allow us to really get the full bandwidth of the communication, that it would try to distill something really nuanced into a metric. But what we did when we presented it to the team is it became a point of discussion. It actually allowed us to now have conversations around things that weren't being discussed before. Now we were getting to that sort of holistic measure. We were using more than one of our senses to get a sense of how the organization was performing. And we had lots of conversation around it. We had a lot of conversation about that one over on the right, which is a C+ if you can't see it. But one of the things that was most interesting is we had this other visualization that we came up with. This is the other visualization we came up with for this data. Now, each one of those dark blue squares is actually a different person's response to the survey. Now, the thing that's really interesting about this visualization is they're not the same. In fact, they're so much not the same that you can see someone over here is rating this really, really low. And over here, we're seeing that it's the same thing as really, really high. And one of the things that this taught us about what was happening in the company, we probably should have recognized it before, but it's really easy when you're inside a company to think that everything that you feel is going wrong and right, all of the problems you see inside your company, all the things that seem to be performing well or not, you start to think that that's really how it is. That that's the actual way that things are in the company, is how you perceive it to be. And what this showed us was that's not the case at all. That each person was coming to the table with a very different and unique perspective. And in order to be able to interact with those different perspectives and be able to sense what was happening in our organization, we needed many nerves. We couldn't rely on a single nerve to be able to sense those things. So as a company, we're still experimenting. We don't have this stuff all figured out. There's a whole bunch of other experiments that I didn't share in this presentation, and there's certainly more experiments that we'll continue to do in the future. But we feel like we're on a journey. We're on a journey that's headed somewhere. We're on a journey that's headed, we hope, to an organization befitting our name, that we can truly be an organization that is mutually human, that takes the lessons from our humanity and applies them to the way that we run our organization. But I want to share you with one last thought before I close. As I have made the transition in my career from focusing on what most people see as design, things that people readily see and they go, ah, yes, he's a designer and he's doing design, and I've moved more into the business side of what it is that I do, I'm surprised by how often I get one question over and over and over again. And the question is, so, how do you like your new role? And underlying this question is sort of a sentiment that I must have had to have left behind design in order to now engage in business. That I might get burned out by this whole new business thing and need to go back and start doing design again because you're not really hooked up for this. But I just have not seen it that way at all. I feel like it's the same role with a different client. My client is the people who work in our company. It's my teammates. My client is our customers by way of them. My client is asking me to do the exact same things that I've been doing throughout the rest of my career. They're asking me to frame problems. They're asking me to propose experiments for how to solve for those problems. And they're asking me to iterate, iterate, iterate. And the cool thing about that is that I would say almost all of you in this room can do all of those things too. So I would encourage you, as you go back into your organizations, there are worthy design problems on the business side of all of our businesses. Go and find some of those worthy design problems. Go find them and solve them using the skills that we all have as designers. because it's fun. So it's your turn. Go do it. So I have a book here, Web Reputation Systems by O'Reilly, donated by O'Reilly for the first person who has a question. Yes?
Do you have any recommendations for those of us who aren't in those positions of power to help, you know, make our own working environments better?
Yeah, well, in the field of biomimetics, they talk a lot about solutions emerging from the bottom of the system. And I think that that's true, that really we need these solutions to begin to surface. For example, I was introduced to the concept of, we do this thing in our company called one-on-ones, where we meet with people each week for about a half hour and just hear what's going on. Not status updates, just how are things going with you inside the company and outside the company? How are things happening? And that idea emerged because someone came to me and they just said, hey, I heard of this thing, and it sounds like a really good idea. What do you think? And they introduced me to the idea, and I did it. I mean, sharing these ideas with leaders who are receptive, and if you don't have leaders who are receptive to change, you need to find another company. But if you do, share your ideas. They'll be receptive. Yeah. Here, I've got stickers for anyone who wants them, but I'll start by giving them to the people who give the next.
Sweet, thank you. I was just curious, right? Would you be crushed if all of your employees didn't have like all of their bars to the absolute top, or would you be able to live with yourself? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and one of the things that we've recognized about the measurement system in general, we have this idea that there might be another way of measuring. We recognize about this system that it suffers from the fact that you're asking people, we're doing it on a quarterly basis, you're asking people at one point in time how they feel. If I asked them every week how they would do it, that bar would probably go up and down over time, right? So we can't ask them the 26 questions or so that we have in the survey every day or every week. But we have been experimenting with the idea of asking people a question, a really simple question. Psychologists struggled with how do you measure happiness? And they've come up with this really, really complex way to measure happiness. They've realized that there's really one best way to do it. You ask people, are you happy? So we've been thinking about doing that on a regular basis, a couple times a week, to try to get a sense for sort of an early warning sign for things that are going right or wrong in the culture of the company. But yeah, no, we're not looking to be perfect. We're just looking to look for improvement. I think the C+ on our report card was the thing that most concerned us, more than the fact that we're not entirely an A.
Could you share with us any other things that you've implemented based on what you've learned, things that you've implemented with your company beyond like the one-on-ones?
Other nerves that we've implemented. Oh, you're going to put me on the spot and I'm going to have to think. There's a lot of things that we're doing. One of the things that we're experimenting with, Bo Burlingham has written a book on open finances. And one of the things that he argues for, and we are looking at attempting to open our finances in our company a lot more than we've ever done before. And what he talks about is that an open finance company is a company where you can see every financial metric in the company, no matter where you are in the company, except potentially, depending on your company, salaries. So you just see those in aggregate. And one of the things that Bo makes the argument for is that this allows for people to be able to do interesting things like, if someone wants to get paid more, one of the things I would like to be able to do in our company is be able to say, yes, I want to pay you more. If you do two things for me, one, tell me what value you're going to add to the company, justify it to us, and two, understand the financial model enough to understand what the impact is going to be on the rest of the company. Because if you can learn to understand that financial model, and I'll help you understand it, but if you can understand that enough, it's going to make you much more sensitive to every decision that we're making. Because I think it's easy for us to write off the business people, I know because I've done it, write off the business people in our company as the assholes that won't let us do what we want to do. But when we start to realize all of the impacts of the decisions that we're making and we see those laid out for us, it can make it a lot more effective. Yes?
I was wondering how you came up with the six B's.
The six B's, that was a long process. We brainstormed a lot and we thought long and hard. It's basically, yeah, it was a lot of time in front of a board thinking about what are the things that we value. It was really, when we came up with the six B's, it was really a reflection of our culture rather than a definition of our culture. We felt like these were the things that we were already doing in the company. And a report card might beg to differ a little bit, but the things that we felt like we were doing or we were aspiring to do, and we wanted to catalog those and create, basically, there's a company locally in Grand Rapids that refers to their values as value mantras, which I really like. It's this idea that you take your values and you repeat them over and over and over again. You give them names so that people can talk about them. Before we had the six B's, the values sort of, they were there and we sort of knew that we had values, but until we gave them names that we could hang on to and talk about, it was an IA problem, right? I mean,
I guess one thing I'm just wondering about is that, are these metrics that you're measuring, do you consider them as like HR metrics, or are they part of your bottom line metrics for your company?
So a number of the metrics that I talked about in the presentation are the metrics that people are sort of focused a little more heavily on the HR side of things, because I think people are more used to measuring things like profit and return, you know, all of the things that you need to measure on the more easily quantifiable side of the business. But like Bo Burlingham's Open Finances, we're looking for ways that we can take and attach the rest of the metrics of the company to the performance of the people who work there. One example of that is we have a profit sharing program in our company. We have a percentage of our profit that we distribute evenly to everyone in the company. So the better the company performs, the more your bonus is going to increase. And so that tries to encourage this idea of each time that you encounter a decision, you make a decision about your own bonus at the end of the day. So thank you very much. I have stickers.
The IA Summit podcast is sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS13. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcast at library.iasummit.org.